a conversation with Mr. James Farmer. Proceed. Let's see if we're getting that. Mr. Farmer, I remember reading somewhere a remark of yours that for you, at least, segregation had been a challenge and a stimulus, that though you had never felt yourself inferior, nevertheless, this gave you a focus for your energies when you were young.
I think that's true. You must understand, of course, that my childhood was somewhat unique, and that my father was a professor at a college practically all of my early life, and I lived on the campus and thus was insulated and isolated from some of the problems in the community.
In a way, then, you could have whatever benefit there would be from the challenge without the deadening weight of direct contact with the process of segregation.
That's right, yes. That I would say that that is true. I would not want this to be interpreted as a justification for segregation.
I think we can avoid that.
Yeah.
That interpretation. Now, challenge is the very essence of achievement, though, isn't it? What kind of challenges do you see as normal for the child or boy, as different from the challenge of segregation?
Well, let me put it this way. I think the greatest challenge that I faced as a child was to prepare myself to try to get rid of segregation, to do what I could to oppose the thing and to bring it down. My entire life was dedicated to that proposition.
You see, CORE was founded in what, 42 or
1942,
41?
1942,
yes. 42. What particular need, what vacuum did you conceive this organization as filling at that time?
Well, at that time, I was working for the Fellowship of Reconciliation as Race Relations Secretary. Now, the Fellowship is a religious pacifist organization. And in the course of my duties, I'd been studying a great deal about Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, his works and his life. And more recently, had taken a tour through the South, a speaking trip, visiting Negro colleges. This was my first trip south since leaving the South in 1938. I visited the South on this tour in the fall of 1941 and came back to Chicago, which was my headquarters then, convinced that something had to be done that was not now being done, that the current approaches to the problem were not adequate. And therefore, I was determined to use the Gandhian techniques in a battle against segregation. We wanted to add new ingredients to the struggle that was then going on.
That is, as opposed to the legalistic approach, is that right for one thing?
Yes, well, not really opposed to it.
I don't mean, I don't mean in place of it.
We saw our approach as supplementing that approach. We felt that the new ingredients that needed to be added were as follows. One, involvement of people themselves, that is, the rank and file, not relying upon the talented tenth, not relying upon the experts and the professionals to do the job. Two, a rejection or repudiation of segregation. In the past, we felt that too many people had lambasted segregation verbally, and had then gone ahead and allowed themselves to be segregated. It was a contradiction, and we felt it was important for individuals to remove themselves from the support of segregation. This was following, in a sense, the views of Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau. And third, an emphasis upon nonviolent direct action, that is, putting one's body into direct confrontation with the evil and the perpetrators of the evil and accepting the consequences of one's action. So it was on these principles that CORE was founded in 1942.
Now, there are several questions come out of that I'd like to have you speak about. One, what results did you look for I don't mean necessarily practical results. Clearly, you're looking for the abolition of segregation. But what changes, or about what process of change do you expect this to come about? Moral awakenings on the part of the white community, for instance? Moral awakenings on the part of the Negro community? What various results as steps toward the achievement of the practical end did you envisage?
Well, we saw, first I ought to say that we looked upon our efforts in the early 40s as being experimental, experimenting with a new technique. And we longed for and dreamed about the development of a mass movement, which fortunately we do have now. But we saw it as first appealing to the conscience of the majority, and second, making the continuation of segregation so expensive that it would become intolerable.
Now, how would you describe that process?
Well,
it was already damned expensive.
It was already damned expensive, yes. And what we wanted to do was to use the economic power through the boycott. And to do that effectively required larger numbers than we had at the outset. We wanted also to get people in their withdrawal of themselves from the support of segregation, to withdraw their money from support of segregation, in terms of financing and subsidizing it, investing, and so forth. These were all a part of the plans initially in CORE.
I was having a quotation here. It runs something like this. It's from Eric Lincoln. He says the question has been at times whether the Negro, well, this hypothetical the Negro is, you know,
yes,
wants real integration, or whether he wants a kind of superficial integration which allows him to feel himself equal in principle, but withdrawn in practice, his own voice, his own community.
Yes.
Now, I assume, I won't speak for you, but I assume that you are interested in actual integration, not superficial integration. That, but then in that case, you have a problem with your Negro community, don't you, too?
Yes, I think this is the great debate that is going on in the Negro community at the present time.
Good. Please analyze that, will you?
Well, I think that most Negroes, I don't want to use the term the average Negro because I don't know what that is, but most Negroes, the rank and file, the ordinary John Doe's whose skin's black. Excuse me. Glenda, yes? Start. Go ahead.
Yes,
now.
Please.
Most Negroes are not really concerned with the issue of segregation, separation versus integration. The real issue for them is getting the heel of oppression off their neck. They know something is hurting them. They're not sure what it is, and they want it removed. Now, Malcolm X and I can address a mass rally, the same audience. He can get an applause talking about separation. I can get an applause talking about integration. And I think that this is a significant fact. Now, it's a responsibility of leadership to analyze this heel of oppression that's on the neck and define it and come up with ideas as to how it can be removed.
You mean isolate the actual aspects of the practical problem?
That's right, yes. And so the debate that's going on is among leadership. Now, I am an integrationist. I believe that the solution is not separation, but it is integration. But it is important for us now to define that integration. What do we mean by it? Do we mean that the Negro, as one-tenth of the population in this country, would be absorbed into white culture, white society, and thus would disappear and lose his identity?
Even the bloodstream disappears.
Yes. And I think not. This is not what I'm searching for. This is not the type of integration that I'm looking for. Instead, I'm looking for a situation whereby the Negro has pride in his culture, his history, the contributions that Negroes have made in American history, and before that in Africa, that he has an identity, that he knows who he is, and has a pride in it. Thus, he can come into an integrated society as a proud and equal partner who has something to give, something to share, and something to receive. Now, that, to me, is more in line with American history than any idea of a merger or an absorption, disappearance. We've had the concept in America of unity through diversity. And I think that the same thing should apply to the racial situation in our country.
This reminds me of the many discussions that appear in the work of Du Bois, you know,
yes,
on the question of the split in the Negro psyche.
That's right.
The pull toward an African tradition, or at least toward the American Negro's cultural tradition, as opposed to all the other things.
Yes.
That is, you don't see that as a real problem, and you see it solved in terms of American pluralisms.
That's right. It is a problem for each individual Negro. As Du Bois put it, every thoughtful Negro at some time has asked himself the question,
yes,
is he an American Negro or is he a Negro American?
Yes. Now, a man may not search, search is the word you used, I believe, for absorption, blood absorption, but it may eventuate.
Yes.
Now, for some Negroes at least, the fact of the eventuation prompts a withdrawal from it, a loss of identity through that absorption.
Mm.
Some do say that.
Of course, yes. I would not shrink from it, however. I think that this should be a permissive absorption. An individual Negro chooses to marry an individual white person, then fine. I do not think that this will happen with most Negroes, or most white people, indeed. Nor do I think that most Negroes will choose to live in what are now lily-white suburbs. I believe, however, that they ought to have a choice, and that it should be an open society. If the Negro wants to live in lovely gardens or lovely lane, then he should do so. But in the foreseeable future, most Negroes are going to choose to live in what are now the ghettos.
This is a matter of choice, you said.
Yes, it should be a matter of choice and not a matter of compulsion.
Compulsion.
That's why I prefer at this stage to speak of it as a battle for desegregation rather than a battle for integration.
Mm-hmm. Because that is what is the first step, or at least if not chronologically, at least logically the first step in the process.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what you're saying?
That's right. This ties in also with another debate that's going on in the whole American society now with regard to race relations. It's whether we want to be colorblind, whether colorblindness is a thing to be sought. Many of our civil rights laws have been based upon the premise of colorblindness in jobs and in housing and so forth. You can't have a quota, you can't look for Negroes, you know, certain number or percentage of Negroes in a housing project. It's illegal to ask the race or to look at the race. When you seek employees, you cannot seek Negro employees or white employees. You must seek employees and so forth. Well, I think that this is a fanciful notion. I don't think that colorblindness in the American concept is a realistic one at all. I think that instead of feeling that we should sit beside a Negro and say, I don't see the color of his skin, I don't know the color of his skin, we should be able to say, yes, I know the color of his skin, he's black, but so what? And that, I think, is more American.
At a university, or college rather, Swarthmore, that I know, they have a very large fund given them to encourage the attendance of Negroes at Swarthmore.
Yes.
It's against the laws of Pennsylvania to inquire into the race, religion, or of an applicant or a possible student.
Yes.
So here you find a strange collision between the... And they have to get around this.
That is right. And I think the laws are wrong. I think the laws are outmoded now and need to be changed. We ran into it in a little campaign we had seeking jobs for Negroes in a small chain of restaurants. The owner, the manager, finally agreed to meet our demands of hiring a certain number of Negroes. But he said that we get our employees through a state employment service. And we certainly can't go to them and ask for 25 Negroes. That would be a violation of the law. Well, I checked with some friends in the state employment service of that particular state, and they said it's very simple. Have the man call us, and we will notify our office, which is in the heart of the ghetto, and tell them to send this man 25 qualified persons, regardless of race, color, creed, or national origin.
Bootleg.
Yes. Well, that's what it is.
Yeah, sure, it's bootlegging.
Yes, but I think the laws as they are now worded are wrong.
Yes.
And that we cannot be colorblind. Now we have to have a color consciousness aimed at wiping out discrimination.
This leads to a matter of quotas, doesn't it?
It does.
How do you conceive of the quota as a provisional, transitional device?
Yes, in housing, I think quota is necessary in order to avoid resegregation. You know, the tipping point after an area or a project becomes more than a certain percentage Negro, then it tends to become all Negro. I think in order to avoid resegregation, we have to have a benign quota. I am in favor of such a quota in employment. For tactical and practical reasons, we do not call for quotas now in employment. We call for numbers instead in order to see the faces, the black faces there.
You mean the number of Negroes, you mean, instead of a quota of Negroes?
Instead of a quota of Negroes, then a number of Negroes as a start.
The quota system does have, in extension, some very grave dangers, doesn't it?
Of course it has dangers, yes. We, in the past, you know, have fought against quotas in colleges and universities.
Yes.
Because we felt that quotas were used to discriminate. But now our quotas can be used to eliminate discrimination that has existed and to create a more equitable situation.
You have read Oscar Hanlon's little book, Bell in the Night, has recently come out.
No, I haven't read it.
He makes, he's very much opposed, I wouldn't say opposed, it's not the word. He is keenly aware of the danger of quota systems if they are not boxed around by controls recognized as limited devices, because they can spread in all kinds of directions.
Mm-hmm.
Defeat the very purpose
right.
they intended. But he also makes the remark that one of the dangers in the present situation is that integration has become a shibboleth, the very word integration, and has led to unrealistic readings of actual situations.
Mm-hmm.
That equality is the key, not integration, because in a situation you can't integrate by any immediate process. As he refers, I think, to the Harlem school situation as an example of that. And certainly will do as an example of that, where you can conceivably aim at equality and work toward integration, but you can't make that the testing point in an overall way, say a New York or Washington school situation. How would you respond to this notion?
Well, there I think it has to be both equality and integration. Our experiences in the past have indicated that in the school system, you cannot have equality under segregation.
That's the fact of the past, there's no question
yes.
about it. But what do you do in a case city like Washington, D.C., when there aren't enough white school children in the public schools to go around to integrate the city?
Well, in that case, you do as much as you can.
As much as you can.
As much as you possibly can, given the situation.
There are some people, some Negroes I know, who say there should be a law to go out in Virginia and corral them and bring them in.
No, that's nonsense. That's sheer nonsense. I think now in the New York City situation, a great deal more can be done than has been done to create integration. And I believe that on the public school level, integration is terribly important. We see it in the development of we see the dangers in not having integration in the development of nationalist sentiment among Negroes and anti-white sentiment. That would be offset if our children studied in the same schools and became friends. I think it's terribly important even to take artificial methods, such as busing sometimes, or such as pairing of schools, or changing the school zones, in order to achieve integration for the sake of letting our children get acquainted.
Dr. King and I were talking about this a few weeks ago, a couple of months ago now, and he was saying, well, at some breaking point in time, 30 minutes might be the upper limit of time on the bus for a child of a certain age, you know. He was saying, he's not right to lay down a program, he was saying, there's some point where we have to have other considerations modify the possibility. A commonsensical view of this. Where do you break this, you see? Say 2 hours each way on a bus is one thing, 30 minutes and 45 minutes is another thing on a bus for children of certain ages. He was simply recognized he was not laying down, say, 30 minutes or 45 minutes, those are the two times he used. He was saying the situation must have a social, a general context.
Mm-hmm.
He would benefit the child.
Mm-hmm.
that he was, I say, not legislating or laying down a schedule or
no.
a distance. He was saying, well, we will see a context
uh-huh.
for the child's benefit, the individual child's benefit
uh-huh.
that's involved in this.
Yeah. Well, I think that the issue of busing has been greatly overplayed and exaggerated, because in any of the solutions that have been offered, the proposals that have been offered for providing integrated quality education in northern cities, busing has been a minor part of such plans. There'd be a limited number of children bused and for comparatively short distances. Also, there is the fact that the people who have opposed busing most vehemently have said, if you bus our children, we'll pull them out of the public school system and send them to private schools, where, incidentally, they would be bused for long distances.
Very often.
Yes, many parents bus their children all over the city
sure.
to
sure.
attend good schools, private schools. Also, in the rural areas, in the counties, busing has become an integral part of the educational system, with the central schools established, you know, for the sake of quality education. So that I think that the issue has been greatly exaggerated, and it's become something that is hung up for discussion.
Smokescreen for some participants in this discussion anyway.
That's right, yeah.
You were saying that you were inclined to believe, correct me if this isn't right, that the hung jury in the two trials of Beckwith were honest, were not rigged for public consumption.
Yes, I'm inclined to believe that. I see no evidence of any rigging of the jury in that regard.
You think that they saw, I beg your pardon?
Mm-hmm. I think that the state knew very well that it would be impossible to get 12 men, or women for that matter, in the state who would vote for conviction. And they probably assumed that there would be either an acquittal or a hung jury.
You said there's a change in Mississippi, though, in recent times of attitude. Is that just exposure to public, to the glare of publicity?
I think so. Mississippi heretofore has felt that it was an island, that it didn't care what the rest of the country or the rest of the world thought, and that what happened in Mississippi was the business of Mississippi and of nobody else. But that came to a rather abrupt end with the Freedom Rides, when 225 people were jailed there. And these people were from all over the country. Their home communities became greatly concerned about it. In fact, one state sent a delegation down to look at conditions in the state penitentiary where the Freedom Riders were. Well, ever since that time, there have been activities in Mississippi, voter registration, demonstrations against segregation, and so forth. So the Mississippi knows now that if one Negro dies, is killed, or if a house is bombed or shot, that it becomes headline news throughout the country. And Mississippi cannot stand aloof from this sort of thing. Say, I'm not convinced that the new awareness in Mississippi of the fact that other people's eyes are on them will affect changes in the segregation system. I think that they are just as convinced, just as determined to maintain segregation as they were 5 years ago or more. But now they realize they have to be a little more sophisticated and subtle about it.
Let's sort out who is the they, you see.
Oh, yes. That's a very good question. I think that Mississippi, as far as the political power structure is concerned, is monolithic on segregation, on this issue. And more than any other state in the country, any other state in the South, it is a police state and is a controlled situation, so that I think that there is some basis for people's suspicion that the jury might have been rigged. I don't think that that massive violence occurs in Mississippi without prior approval. There are no accidents in that sense. If there's massive violence, then the word has been given. And violence can be prevented in Mississippi. For example, when the Freedom Riders came in to the state, everyone knew we were coming in, they knew when. Yet Ross Barnett, who was governor at the time, went on the air, went on television every day before the Freedom Riders came in, telling people the race mixers, as he called them, are coming into our state. Forget about it. He said, don't come into town. Don't get your guns. Don't do anything. But let us handle it. And we'll handle it according to law and order, and we will see to it that the state segregation laws will be supported and maintained, upheld. And that's what happened. There was a crowd of people at the bus terminal, but these people were largely reporters, plainclothesmen, and policemen. There were no mobs. They stayed home. Now, in Alabama, you can have accidental mob mass violence because it's not that efficient in its police operation. The police in Mississippi are more efficient than police I have seen operate any place else in the country. It's like clockwork with precision. About a month before Mentor Everest was shot, I was riding with him from Greenwood to Clarksdale to see Dr. Henry. And night had fallen. He had asked me to go along with him, partly because he didn't want to drive alone at night. As we drove along, he told me that he didn't really go along with nonviolence as completely as some of the people in the movement. And if I looked in his glove compartment, I would find a loaded .45 there. And furthermore, every time he gets in his car, he checks under the hood and under the seat and everything else. Well, he said, in addition, nothing passes him on the highways of that state at night. We were going about 70 miles an hour. And after a while, he commented to me that the car behind us, which had four men in it, had been with us for 15 miles. And we've got to lose it, he said. We went up to 80. They stayed with us. We went up to 90, up to 100. Then the speedometer registered 110 before we pulled away from them. And he told me that he doesn't let anything pass him because he'd had too many experiences of being stopped at night or attempts being made to block his car or force him off the road. And also there have been many cases recently where people have had rather surprising accidents on the highway, which he does not believe were accidents. He said, in addition, lynchings still go on in the state. That bodies, not infrequently, black bodies, that is, float down the Pearl River.
There have been five unexplained killings I read in the paper since last January in Mississippi.
Five unexplained killings?
Yes, mm-hmm. I read this.
Were they all Negroes?
All Negroes, yes. Mm-hmm. This is my recollection of some one news story. Mm-hmm.
I know, when I got out of jail, out of Parchman State Penitentiary, on that particular day, I was the only male who was bailing out. There were several girls who were bailing out. There were two vans to take us back to town, back to Jackson. I was put in the large one, all alone. The girls were put in the small one. Well, I later found out why this was done. It was to give me a rough ride, you know, starting suddenly, stopping suddenly, hitting curbs, and have me tumble all over the huge van. But before we got in the van, a van drove up with new girl freedom riders who were being brought to Parchman. Some of them recognized me and began singing freedom songs. It was a serenade. There were two Mississippians standing there, chewing tobacco or smoking. One of them said to the other, and he looked at me, he must be one of the big shits. The other one said, yeah, if I could get my hands on him, he'd be a dead ship. This was said just loud enough for me to hear. I found out the man who made the latter comment was the driver of the van taking me back to Jackson. Here I was locked into the huge police van with this driver. He made it a very rough trip, and when I would look out of the barred window and see that we were approaching a bridge, I, in my mind's eye, could see him turning the steering wheel and jumping out. It was a rather horrifying trip.
I'll bet. Did you read the report in press about Charles Evers' speech at Nashville?
No, I didn't.
At the NAACP dinner?
No. What did he say?
Well, I don't know, you see. All I know is the press. Mm-hmm. I don't know anybody who's actually there. This was It may be verbal, it may be something more than verbal. You reminded me of by speaking of his brothers being armed, brother being armed, which I knew. For instance, Mr. Lawson told me, and others have told me that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, in Nashville, according to the press, the Nashville press, he said that he preached unselective reprisal. If a church is bombed, we will bomb a church. He used the word we. We have decided, actually it's a phrase. If a children are killed in a church, we will bomb a church with children. Non-selective reprisal, you see, straight down the line. And I wrote him about this, and he said that he had been misrepresented.
Yes.
I checked back on the reporter. The reporter is a Negro reporter, a graduate of Fisk University, wrote the report, and he was called in by the editor of the newspaper and said, you stand on this, you're sure you have this? He said, yes. So there we rest, you see. Some say that he simply was carried away with the occasion. This didn't represent his responses. I don't think it's very important, but it was used very, I think, unfortunately by people against him. I regret that it happened, but that way it did happen.
I don't know Charles Evers' views. I've met him only once, and on that occasion didn't have a chance to talk with him. But I do know that such views would be in conflict with the official views of the NAACP.
I know that, too.
I remember Robert Williams' case.
Sorry. End of tape one of the conversation with Mr. Farmer. See tape two.